This is Free Speech Radio News. From New York, I'm Dorian Marina. It's Friday, November 27, 2009, and today FSRN brings you an exclusive documentary, The Rebirth of Segregated Schools, produced by reporter Karen Miller. Stay with us. Segregated schools sound like a relic of America's Jim Crow past. Legal separation that relegated black students to substandard facilities and resources was officially done away with Brown versus Board of Education. But segregated schools are making a comeback in practice. According to the Civil Rights Project at the University of California, black and Latino students are more segregated now than they've been for more than four decades. And white students continue to be the most racially isolated. Brown versus Board of Education required local school boards to desegregate, but in the 1990s, the Supreme Court decided that if a school board had dealt with segregation in principle, it was not required to deal with ongoing segregation in practice caused by factors such as white flight. Other Supreme Court rulings followed suit, and over the last 20 years, students have become increasingly isolated along racial lines. In this documentary, FSRN's Karen Miller takes a look at the resegregation of U.S. schools.
It's recess at Murch Elementary in Washington, D.C. On the playground, 9-year-old Gregory Jefferson talks about his best friend, Owen Hansen.
He's like the class clown, and he's really funny, and he's a good friend to me. He helps me with some of my problems. He's sort of a tutor for me for some stuff I can't do.
Owen also has good things to say about Gregory.
Well, he's always standing up for me. He's never going and taking someone else's side. He always does the right thing.
Gregory and Owen live near each other and met at school. Gregory recalls their first introduction.
Owen brought him cupcakes this one day, and it was chocolate. I don't like chocolate. And I was like, I don't like chocolate. He's like, oh, I'll give you something else that one day that's vanilla. So, but he never did, but we're still friends. So, yeah.
So do you remember that day?
Yeah, second day of school.
Yep. So do you guys ever talk about, you know, how like one of you is black and one of you is white or anything? Do you guys ever talk about anything like that at all?
No, because we're just really good friends. We don't talk about that.
I don't get why people think that's a difference. I mean, everyone's the same.
Just like Martin Luther King said, it doesn't matter about the color.
Well, I mean, we really think of each other as brothers, I guess. Mm-hmm. So that's probably it, right?
Yeah.
So you guys think of each other as brothers?
Yeah. Yes, we do.
Friendships like those between Gregory and Owen are familiar to Secretary of Education Arnie Duncan.
I was very fortunate to grow up in a diverse community and to go to school and to grow up with children who didn't always look like me or come from my background. And that was absolutely invaluable to me and my sister and brother.
But a disturbing trend is now putting experiences like those of Duncan, Gregory, and Owen in danger. Schools are resegregating. Gary Orfield with the Civil Rights Project out of UCLA.
We are now at a level of segregation for black students that we last saw in the 1960s. All of our progress since that time has been obliterated.
Orfield says it's not just a black and white issue.
For Latino students, we have a level of segregation that's really unprecedented.
Orfield's data shows that white students are the most racially isolated. Statistics indicate the average white student goes to a school that's nearly 80% white, but white children make up only 55% of the student population. That's a big change from the late 1960s, when the racial composition of U.S. school students was 80% white, 14% black, 5% Latino, and 1% Native American. According to the National Center for Education Statistics, now that breakdown is 55% white, 17% black, 21% Latino, 4% Asian, and 1% Native American. That means students of color make up more than 40% of U.S. students. But despite this increase in overall diversity, integration at the local school level has actually decreased over the last 20 years. This has Secretary Duncan concerned.
When students don't have a chance to grow up comfortable and confident around people who don't look like themselves, and don't have a similar background, I worry that an increasingly diverse and global economy, that their prospects in the job market will be diminished, that they won't be comfortable working together. And the idea of teamwork is hard. And so it's something that I worry about a lot. I think it is hugely important. And it's obviously something you can't teach in algebra. You can't teach it in biology. You learn those things on the playground and at lunchtime and, you know, on the weekends hanging out with friends.
But hanging out with friends of a different race has never been the reality for many U.S. school students. And to understand how the U.S. got on the road to resegregation, it's important to look at the roots of segregation. Prior to Brown v. Board of Education in 1954, America largely educated children of color under the doctrine of separate but equal. In the 1890s, the Supreme Court decided in the case Plessy v. Ferguson that a state could require racial segregation in public facilities if the separate facilities were equal. Schools were the first on the list. Jim Carr is Chief Operating Officer for the National Community Reinvestment Coalition and former Vice President for Housing Research at Fannie Mae.
By isolating people through segregation, that was the way to deny them access to opportunities on a wholesale basis. And that included isolation from location of jobs, isolation from recreational centers, you know, the really good pools, the tennis courts, the basketball courts, isolation from the best public medical facilities. The cornerstone of isolation, however, was isolation from the best schools.
67-year-old Eugene Williams remembers the days of segregation well. He grew up in Virginia and says segregation impacted every aspect of life.
When we went into the department stores, we could not try on the garments as we do today. We can do it today. Blacks were not allowed to try them on. They had to buy them. And then if they were too large, it was up to mom or dad or aunt to do whatever was necessary to make it fit.
But it was at school that William says he felt the offense the most.
Textbooks that we received, torn and tattered. You know, I was concerned when I got a textbook and it had about 20 names in it. That meant that approximately 20 white students had used that book. And that gave me a lot of concern.
William says the town's white students had access to modern facilities, but black students got something different.
A two-room school with two teachers, potbelly stoves, and first, second, third grade in the same classroom, and then the other grades in the other classroom.
States sent fewer resources and less funding to black schools, and their teachers received less pay. African Americans had tried to challenge segregation since Plessy v. Ferguson, but the real break came with Brown v. Board of Education, a case initiated by the NAACP in Topeka, Kansas. 13 African American parents tried to enroll their children in segregated white schools in the area. All were denied. The NAACP picked Oliver Brown, the only male, as the lead plaintiff. The Brown case was also part of a broader effort, including cases from Delaware, Kansas, South Carolina, Virginia, and Washington, D.C. Brown v. Board of Education ended up having a total of 200 plaintiffs that challenged separate but equal. Evidence included the results of psychological tests that identified the harmful effects of segregation. Jim Lyons is a former researcher at the Metropolitan Applied Research Center. He also worked with the Carter and Reagan administrations on school desegregation plans. He explains what the scientists did.
Present adults that were identical except in color to 3 to 5 year old children, and they simply said, "Talk to me about the doll." And the children talked about the doll. And of course, sadly, both white and black children said the same thing about the dolls. They almost uniformly ascribed negative characteristics to the black doll and positive characteristics to the white doll.
Chief Justice Earl Warren stated in his written opinion that separate but equal violated the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution.
We come then to the question presented.
does segregation of children in public schools solely on the basis of race, even though the physical facilities and other tangible factors may be equal, deprive the children of the minority group of equal educational opportunities? We believe that it does.
There were, however, elements missing from the court case. Again, Lyons.
What is sad about the legacy of Brown versus Board of Education is the court didn't cite the full story or study. It didn't cite the harm that was done to white children by segregation, the unrealistic feelings of superiority, the arrogance that it bred in white children.
Segregation affects the worldview of children across color lines. 61-year-old Paul Weckstein was a first grader at the time of the Brown versus Board ruling. He never had a classmate of color and says the racial isolation affected him and his classmates growing up in Long Island, New York.
I can remember, when I got to high school, a civics class did a survey of the kids in our school about their awareness of, things. And so they asked, what's the population of the United States racially and religiously? And, I think the answer was 1 or 2% black and all the rest white. They didn't see black people. 40% Catholic, 35% Jewish, 10% Protestant. That was their perception.
The Brown versus Board ruling in 1954 dismantled the legal basis for racial segregation in schools, but it didn't set a binding time frame. A case the following year, known as Brown 2, said schools had to desegregate with, quote, all deliberate speed, which meant in some cases nothing was done for years. But the Civil Rights Act of 1964 allowed the federal government to deny funds to schools that were still segregated. This, along with other Supreme Court rulings, led to a wave of students being exposed to each other in ways that had never happened before. William Buster attended public integrated schools near Charlotte, North Carolina, from kindergarten through high school.
My white friends that I came up with are just my white friends that I grew up with. I punched them like I would punch my cousin, It was just that, it was that natural for us.
But the integrated school system Buster graduated from in 1989 is not the same today.
They're getting segregated again, Latino and black, in a community that I grew up in. So it's becoming very much a black and brown school, and the white kids are being whisked away to other parts of the county.
In the 1990s, the Supreme Court ruled that once the school system had done all it could do to wipe out the effects of past racism, they would no longer be under court order to desegregate. Francisco Negron is the Associate Executive Director of the National School Boards Association.
We're really living in what we call post-integration America, where now, years after legal segregation, which of course we know after Brown, the court declared unconstitutional, we're now living in a society where communities are resegregating, either through voluntary migration, through business patterns, through zoning, for reasons that are, as we say in the law, de facto reasons, not because the law compels them.
However, some schools have continued with desegregation efforts. Again, Negron.
When students come from a highly racially isolated school, and those students, particularly minority students, then are placed in an environment that is not predominantly minority, they tend to perform better as measured by standardized test scores, with no diminishment in the grades or the performance of the majority students.
Beyond the benefits of integration and academic achievement, Congressman Chaka Fatah of Pennsylvania says America needs to pursue diversity as part of an economic agenda.
The greatest problem with productivity in the workplace was the inability of people from different backgrounds to work together, that racial problems, that religious differences, gender issues were challenging in the workplace. So if we want to be economically prosperous, we do need to work through these issues of people being able to get along. And the best place to do that is in the schoolhouse.
That's why Professor of Human Development Melanie Killen from the University of Maryland says one-on-one close personal relationships are critical.
The most significant predictor for reducing prejudice is cross-race friendships. That the extent to which you have a friend, not just someone in your class, but you have a friend who's from a different racial ethnic group, that can really dramatically reduce prejudice. Why? Because, you know, when you're friends with somebody from a different racial ethnic group, that helps you to challenge all those stereotypes that you get bombarded with through the society and media and movies and everything else. So when we, you know, when children have friends of different racial backgrounds and they see a stereotype, they can think, well, my friend's not like that.
Ayanna Sutton is a 2009 graduate of Dunbar High School in Washington, D.C. It's 98% black and 2% Hispanic.
If white kids don't learn about black kids in school, where do they learn about black kids?
The media. I would say that because 9 times out of 10 you turn on the news, it's always the housing project that's on the news, or they're talking bad about young black males or females. So they really don't get a chance to like actually learn us and understand where we're coming from. They only go by what they hear or what they see.
Learning about others is something Bill Komsky says he missed out on going to predominantly white schools in Oklahoma.
Just cultural awareness and the ability to get along with other folks. I mean, I think it made a huge difference. It was sort of a bubble.
Komsky says his first black friend in a classroom came in college.
An ethics class where there was an African-American guy that we became friends, and just his whole life experience and perspective was really enriching to me personally, and it's a great friendship that we had. Okay. He'd ask me questions like why I like to go backpacking, and I'd ask him questions about his background. It was funny.
The effects of racial isolation may become even more pronounced in the future as the demographics of America change to such an extent that the past definitions of the words majority and minority are also changing. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, minorities, meaning blacks, Latinos, Asians, and Native Americans, are expected to become the majority of the population by 2042. Minority children are predicted to comprise more than half of all children in the U.S. by 2023.
You are listening to The Rebirth of Segregated Schools, an exclusive FSRN documentary on the resegregation of U.S. education, produced by Karen Miller.
Funding levels often define a school's demographics. Jack Johnson says he noticed a difference in his own educational experience.
I was educated on south side of Chicago, which was pretty much segregated. And many of those schools remain segregated. Frank L. Gillespie Elementary School. When I was 12, I was sent to live with my father, and he lived in the south suburbs, a much more integrated area. Probably 60% white, 40%, some 30-35% African American. But what I also recognize, I was fine in Chicago public schools academically. When I moved to the south suburbs, I recognized that there were some academic challenges. It speaks again to the quality of resources, the quality of teachers, and teacher preparation that was occurring in those school settings.
According to the advocacy group, the Education Trust, school districts that serve a high concentration of students of color receive on average $1,100 less per student than districts that serve predominantly white students. There's also a higher concentration of poverty among students who go to majority-minority schools. This means students don't have access to one of the predictors of academic success, exposure to middle-class backgrounds. It also could mean students may have a hard time getting into college because of the reputation of a segregated school. Jim Carr from the National Community Reinvestment Coalition.
One of the things that's missing from the conversation is the imperative. Why is this important? Because if we only think about this educational puzzle in terms of, well, it's the right thing to do, and it's a nice thing to do, and it's the just thing to do, and we need to do this for civil rights reasons. Well, those are all important, and we should do them. By the way, we should do it because discrimination is illegal, and that's why we have the problem. So we need to, you know, make reparations for the problems that we've caused. But having said that, a major imperative also is, if we're going to have a competitive country, We need a competitive workforce. That workforce has to be educated in the 21st century.
Academic and economic benefits aside, there's another roadblock to integration in schools, the composition of our neighborhoods. Again, recent D.C. high school graduate Ayanna Sutton.
So why don't you feel like there were more white students that went to your school?
I would say because our school is near our neighborhoods, which white people would consider the projects.
Whites are talked out of going to communities of color to live, and blacks are talked out of going to non-Hispanic white communities. And when I say talked out of, it's not like they say you don't want to live there because they're blacks. That may happen, but usually it's much more subtle than that. It's like you don't want to live there, the schools are not really good, or they diminish other aspects of the community to a white family searching. And to the black family, they promote those things. And they say, you know what, it's really convenient and blah, 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 blah. And you really want to live because that's the great place, and talk them out of the white neighborhood.
Some school districts have set up magnet schools to achieve a more proportionate demographic mix. Magnet schools were first established in the 1960s and 70s as part of voluntary desegregation efforts. The schools allow students from different zones to enroll in programs with a particular academic or artistic focus. But David Hornbeck, former superintendent of schools for the state of Maryland, says magnet schools can have a drawback.
They too often, at least in many of our cities, become substitutes for focusing on excellence in all of the schools, or at least there's always a danger that if we can get a few schools that are really, really good and build them up, well, we can't do anything about all those other schools anyhow.
Some school districts looking to maintain desegregation voluntarily had adopted student assignment plans. But in 2007, the Supreme Court called these plans into question. One such case involved the Seattle School District, where race could be used as a tiebreaker in school placement. White parents objected, arguing their children were being denied entrance to a school of their choice because of race. The school district said the goal of the plan was to maintain diversity. But during the oral argument, Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy questioned Seattle School's attorney Michael Madden on the use of race to decide who gets in.
The question is whether or not you can get into the school that you really prefer. And that, in some cases, depends solely on skin color. It's like saying that everybody can have the meal, but only people of a separate skin can get the dessert.
Well, sometimes students, in the end of the day, have an assignment determined by race. So at some point, race will be a tipping factor. Different, though, we put someone in a basically comparable school.
But Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts fired back at Madden.
I mean, everyone got a seat in Brown as well. But because they were assigned to those seats on the basis of race, it violated equal protection. How is your argument that there's no problem here because everybody gets a seat distinguishable?
Because segregation is harmful. Integration has benefits.
Justice Ruth Ginsburg sided with the school.
Using race for integration is the same as segregation. Seems to me pretty far from the kind of headlines that attended the Brown decision. They were, at last, whites and white and black children together on the same school bench. That seems to be worlds apart from saying we'll separate them.
We certainly agree, Justice Ginsburg, and would go one step further and note that in Brown, this court said that the effects of segregated schools are worse.
The court concluded that schools can indeed promote diversity, but a person's skin color can't be the deciding factor. Francisco Negron, Associate Director of the National School Boards Association.
You can use race in a very limited way, and it can't be a tiebreaker as was the case in Seattle. So now schools are looking at the kinds of things that many schools have already been doing. They have been looking at things like geographic location, sibling attendance. Do your siblings attend the same school? What kinds of education do your parents have? And so using factors like this, socioeconomic factors, geography, educational levels, they've created indices through rather complicated formulas to decide who gets to go to the school in hopes of creating diverse student bodies.
Even though there may be recognition of the benefits of integration by the Obama administration, funding for programs that promote integration in all school districts may be a different story. In the 2010 budget, the administration has set aside $104 million for magnet programs. But this pales in comparison to the funding allocated for charter and school excellence programs. Duncan says integration may happen by default.
The one thing that I found that works is quality schools. That if we have more good schools, parents from very diverse backgrounds will go to a good school that's not in their community because they want the best for their children. And so when I talk about turning around fundamentally underperforming schools, if we can put extraordinarily high-performing schools into communities, we can't change housing patterns tomorrow. That's out of our control. What we do control is if we can put great, great schools into communities, parents will find a way to get their kids there.
But Professor Theodore Shaw of Columbia University and former head of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund says the pressure still needs to be put on the administration to make sure integration is a focus.
The country, in fact, holds Brown versus Board of Education in a position where it's a hallowed decision. I have come to say that it's hallowed, but hollowed. It's a decision that everybody claims to support. So it's hallowed, but it's hollowed because, in fact, mandatory desegregation is a thing of the past.
Jim Lyons, who worked with school desegregation under the Carter and Reagan administrations, says America needs to ask a new set of questions.
Are schools reflective of the world in which our children will live? Do our schools teach children not only the academic content, but do they teach them the larger moral and cultural lessons that are to be derived from diversity? It's profoundly important to understand the world is not white, the world is not English-speaking, the world is multicultural. And until we can recognize that the multiculturalism, the racial diversity that we have in this country is our greatest asset, we will never be all that we can be.
Brooke and Thais know about Brown versus Board of Education, but they never talk about it. They're just friends. It's Saturday night at the Pentagon City Mall in Arlington, Virginia. They are, in their own words, just kicking it at the food court. Thais talks about what she and Brooke like to do together.
We be chilling outside and go to homecoming and stuff like that.
Thais and Brooke live a couple of houses down from each other and go to the same school. The school they go to is racially mixed. Thais says at their school, even where people sit in the cafeteria passes the test.
Everybody's just together. I mean, I think everybody's with everybody. White people sit with black people sit with white people, Asians, Mexicans, whatever. If that's your friend, that's your friend. It's not like a racial, it's not segregated or anything.
Some schools continue to desegregate. But in the age of court rulings, housing trends, and school excellence, they do it carefully. As they continue their efforts, hopefully more friendships like Brooke and Thais will have the opportunity to develop in the future.
Today's documentary, The Rebirth of Segregated Schools, was produced by Karen Miller. Shannon Young is our documentary editor. This and other documentaries are available for download at our website, fsrn.org. We'll be back with our regular newscast on Monday. In New York, I'm Dorian Marina.